Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Kevin Conti, the founder of Software Ideas, and our topic for today is product ideas. This episode is brought to you by Hover. Register a domain name for your design portfolio and choose from over 300 domain name extensions. No matter what area of the creative space you're in, there is a domain name waiting for it, from .design and .art to .ink, .photo, and more. Check them out at hover.com/UIbreakfast. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing great. Thanks so much for joining us. We have so much to learn from you. But before that, let's talk a little bit about your background and the project background.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a full-time software developer. I'm doing side projects on the side. My first SaaS product came out in June of this year. It's called CoderNotes.io. And I had felt I had learned a lot from it. And from that, it's kind of a long story. We can definitely dive into it. But I came up with the idea for Software Ideas and launched that July 6th. And it's growing really, really fast, already up into about 3,700 MRR and continuing to grow. So I've just had a blast with it so far.
Amazing. Well, let's dive into that interesting story, how you came up with the idea for a project that runs ideas. And actually, this is, I think it's a third episode here that deals with the ideas kind of thing. One is Trends.vc by Drew Reilly, who was here on the show a while ago, and also Casper Staniel of Scrapbook, who does marketing ideas. Now we do product ideas with you. And it's amazing how these newsletters and products manage ideas and do really well doing so.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I've had a couple talks with Drew. He's a really cool guy. People should definitely check out his newsletter if they haven't already, or his subscription. So the idea behind Software Ideas was actually, originally, it was just me looking for my next SaaS product. So I was at a point with CoderNotes. It had launched to the hundreds of dollars of MRR. I was happy with it because, well, I guess I should give some background on that product first. So CoderNotes is a note-taking application for software developers. I had looked at the existing solutions on the market, but I wasn't happy with anything I had found. I really wanted a note-taking solution where you could just search and it would be smart enough, kind of like Google, to find the note you were looking for, where you didn't have to worry about what you had named it or what labels you had put on it. So based on that, kind of scratching my own itch, I had made this product. And it had gotten a lot of interest. It had done like number two on Product Hunt. And the interesting thing about it was it had gotten a lot of interest, but it hadn't gotten a lot of sales. So I found this, I had found that I had learned a lot, like, okay, so when you're looking for a product idea, it's not just about what you think is cool, and it's not even necessarily about what other people think is cool, because sometimes that doesn't actually drive market demand. It doesn't drive sales. So I started doing research. I said, I have two options. I can either pivot CoderNotes into something new that's going to have a little bit better market interest, or I can take what I've learned and work from the ground up in a way that might be more reliable, help get traction quicker. So I was looking at a couple ideas and I was doing all this research trying to find different opportunities, and I was looking at it a new way. I was looking at, well, what markets already exist that make money, where there's money exchanging hands on a daily basis? Because note-taking for developers, there's not too much, you know, most developers don't buy a note-taking app. They use comments in their code or something. So I was really caring about this kind of concept. So I was looking at markets that already had that, and eventually I said, okay, well, you know what? This research that I'm doing might actually be valuable in and of itself. And the databases I was using to look up these markets and find this financial information on private companies costs a lot of money. It's about $1,000 for a year. And I said, well, you know, maybe I can turn this research into a newsletter and recoup the costs while I'm still continuing to do research for my own software ideas. And I validated that interest by a process we can talk about, because I have this kind of more strict process for myself now about how I am going through ideas and validating them to make sure they're not just cool, but they actually have, you know, market demand. I pre-sold about 200 some dollars of the product before it was even built before it was even a thing. And from there, I knew, you know, it was a good idea, and it's taken off since then. So that's kind of the full story of it. It happened, the Software Ideas product kind of happened out of accident, but also following a strong process of figuring out how to find product ideas that have that market demand behind them.
This story resonates with me on so many levels. My first SaaS product a while ago also didn't go anywhere because it was a non-existent / non-popular category. And then for the next one, user list, I was like, we're going to build something that is really having a market and really like defined product category. And the research that you mentioned, well, there are different kinds of validation, and we can talk about that now. One is validating with your particular customers, but you can also look at other products and how they're doing. And that's a great understanding of what kind of money there is in the field. What is your particular framework for doing that research?
Yeah, totally agree with that. So I think that step one is to look at the market overall and say, okay, is money exchanging hands in this market? Are there similar companies like mine, but maybe they do it a slightly different way? UserList is a great example, right? Because there are competitors. There's people who do similar things, but you guys have such a great positioning angle. You focus specifically on a certain type of user, and that's what drives interest. So really, really happy with that. Basically, is kind of the same way I do it, where I look at the market, look at the companies, and say, okay, what's a unique angle we can take? Or is there, a lot of times in markets, there's a couple big players. They're either VC backed or just highly profitable. And because they're so big and they're targeting maybe enterprise customers, things like that, I say, or I usually look at a niche. I say, okay, well, what niches are there in this market? Maybe groups of people that all have a same set of characteristics or things they want, that because the bigger company has to cater to the entire market, they can't focus or specify on that particular set of features or just those customers in general. And that's where I tend to write about the opportunities in the newsletter. So to summarize, like, look at a whole market, look at the companies in the market, figure out how they're positioning, what features are resonating with their users, and then find, is there a group of users, like a niche in there, that isn't fully satisfied with the existing offerings, and then figure out what's missing for them. What's the most critical feature that would make them love a product, and then figure out how to offer an MVP that capitalizes on that.
How do you figure out the list of the companies within a niche? Because there is no such a thing as like the internet directory where you can like come in and see, all right, this is 121 company that does customer messaging. Like, what do you do to do that?
I find that you can normally find the bigger companies. Like, once you find one bigger company, you can find out who their competitors are. A lot of that goes back to the two databases that I use that I mentioned that I had to pay for. They're called Owler.com and Crunchbase.com. Those two are paid, what would you call them? Databases, basically, where you can look up public and private company information. They often include competitor lists and rankings. And you can also go to review sites, things like G2.com or Capterra, and they'll do a good job of saying, you know, here's this company and here's what their users like over this other company. And the last thing you can do, which is kind of a hack, is you can type the name of the company that you know is in that market and then type versus, like VS, in Google search. And then, you know, all those pages that have become popular, which is like our website versus this other website, and they talk about their features. That's another way I go through and find competitors.
These are all so helpful. But do you have any process on actually figuring out what niche to research next for your newsletter? Because it's not just one research round that you're doing, but you were on a content treadmill for your subscribers, right? Yep. So where do you get inspiration for that?
A lot of that is coming from, so this is where I think the value of the newsletter comes from, is because slogging through all of these different companies is tedious work and it's a pain. So some of the convenience is just like, I'm already providing some of that grunt work for the reader. I've tried a lot of different ways of finding ideas. I've gone through the Inc. 5000 list because that's usually a good source of VC-backed companies or very profitable companies, because those are the fastest growing 5,000 companies. Basically, I look for lists of that would lead me to companies that are fast growing or VC backed or highly profitable. So Inc. 5000 is one. I was going through just the Crunchbase listings, just going like alphabetically for a while. And that's one of the databases I mentioned. There's the Capterra software categories, which is really good. And yeah, I don't have a great answer. Like, you can't just go online and find like the perfect list for this. It's a lot of going and looking at companies and researching them until you understand, okay, here's the overall market they're playing in and here's who they're competing against. And once you have those two things, you can kind of make a whole picture of what exactly is going on in that software category. And interestingly enough, I've already had readers reply to me and say, hey, you wrote about my company and you actually did a really good job. So that always makes me feel good when I'm like, oh, cool, I hit the mark there.
Can you give us a couple examples of niches that you consider profitable or interesting? Maybe some content examples from your past issues?
Sure, yeah. So the one that's fresh in my mind, because the newsletter is about to go out as we're writing or as we're recording this today, is a typical niche example we did of review management and monitoring. So I looked at one of the most popular, and this was actually back a while ago. I looked at the most popular review management software. So there's a lot of businesses out there who rely on reviews in order to get more business. Think of like cleaners or like local service workers, also things like chiropractor care facilities, things like that. Those kind of businesses, Yelp is so important to them, and similar review sites like that, Google reviews, so important to them. That's what drives their traffic. That's what drives their business and their reputation. So these review tracker softwares have been out there, and their main purpose is, instead of you as the, you know, busy owner having to go to each review website and check for new reviews and respond to them if they're negative and, you know, say thank you if they're positive, and also encouraging your existing users to actually go and write a review on a platform you want, it tries to bundle all that into a software. So the way I found out about that is, I think that one, I went to the Capterra software category for review managers or something like that. And I found out about this market. You know, I'd never known about it before. Read deep into it, learned about all these different companies, and one of them is called Review Trackers. Learned about what its users liked about it. And then the original opportunity I wrote was, okay, this is a great example of an opportunity where you can niche, because the example I gave was a review tracking software specifically for chiropractors. Because for a chiropractor, you might have specific review sites that a general big review site can't or won't track, right? Like if you were going to make a review manager or like a site review manager for like SaaS, B2B SaaS companies, maybe as a different example of a niche, there's certain review sites you would care about, like G2.com and Capterra.com, things like that. Whereas for chiropractors, they don't care about that. So these bigger companies, they can't care about every single review site for every single niche. So I said, okay, well, if you wanted to focus on a specific niche, that's a great opportunity there. The example at the time I gave was for chiropractors. And just today, I'm releasing, once a quarter, I do what I call a hidden gems newsletter, where I release an update to like three ideas that I really like that no one has taken up yet. So this is one of the ones I did, which is why it's so fresh in my mind. It turns out that in 2020, a company incorporated, I'm forgetting the name of it right now, that is doing review management for chiropractors. So it's exactly the opportunity I had been talking about. And they are already going up towards the six-figure MRR, right? Like, they've just killed it. So to me, you know, on one hand, that's kind of like, oh, that stinks. Like, the chiropractor niche here is already taken. But what I wrote about today was, listen, this just proves the market, right? The model here, where take review, find a niche that, you know, has these niche review websites that you want to access and distribute from, and create a product based on that, catering to that specific audience. You know, here's an example of a company that just did it in 2020 and is doing really, really well.
Can you give us, like, reassure our listeners why they shouldn't be scared as entrepreneurs to enter populated markets and address a certain niche within them?
Yeah, that's a totally fair question. And I've had people talk to me before and say, look, I don't even want to tell you my idea, because I can't tell anyone about my idea, because then it's going to get copied. And any competition, you know, would ruin me. And my thought around that is just, I don't know if that's exactly right, but I get where it's coming from. Like, it totally makes sense. I think the biggest problem bootstrappers, like most bootstrappers I see who are struggling, myself in the past included, have run into, is you build something that's cool but doesn't have that market demand. And that's just, it seems to be so common. People build stuff and there's just no interest. Like there's just no sales, no interest. And there's multiple reasons for that. But one of them is that they're entering in a market that just, there's not money already there, not money already trading hands. So my philosophy is to go into a market where there's money trading hands and then find a unique angle in that market that lets you outcompete. I think the old way of doing it was find a market that no one has traded money in before and then try to get it to be popular enough that people will put money into it. And that's doable. Like we all know examples of companies that have, you know, created this brand new thing. Like what Elon Musk right now is doing, that Neuralink headset or chip in your brain. Like that hasn't been done before. That's a new market with that'll have new money. But you have to think about the kind of marketing money and just his reputation already that's causing all this distribution for an opportunity like that. A bootstrapper is not going to have that level of being able to get this product in front of people's face. So when you get it in front of their face, you kind of want them to already know about it and ideally know they already want something like that. And what you're doing is just saying, hey, here's my unique spin on this thing. And they're saying, oh, that is exactly the thing I needed as like who I am in this market, if that makes sense.
I think this should be like Bootstrapper 101 taught somewhere in the university, you know, that you should not be inventing a product category. And yes, of course, you can promote a new one, but it usually involves a lot of marketing money, like investment or anything. And that is not a Bootstrapper path typically.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you mentioned the Bootstrapper 101 because I feel that from my first product, the biggest thing I took away is some of these fundamentals. So I've been trying to share them around. And one of the ways I'm doing that is I'm actually doing a small course right now called The Foundation, which is part of the Software Ideas subscription right now. And I'm trying to go through some of these things, these common mistakes that I see being made that, you know, people talk about them all the time, but a lot of times I hear it in terms of like, here's the problem is like, you're not going in a category with enough interest. But a lot of times for a new founder, it's hard to understand what's enough interest. So what I'm trying to do with this course is be a lot more of a case study and example. I'm trying to do things like I'm releasing like all the customer interviews I've done and showing like how I got all the pre-sales and trying to give a nice concrete path through how, when you first have an idea, how to go about starting to ask people about their thoughts in a way that isn't leading them to an answer. I recommend pre-sales, which I feel like isn't talked about too often, but I think it's the easiest way for bootstrappers to de-risk, you know, the fact that people won't want what they make. So we can definitely get into pre-sales a bit if you're interested, and going through and keep going on that path. So that's something I'm doing right now and something I'm actively working on.
We're not going to go in pre-sales because it's a big topic on its own. This is my second business that we're running now, and it's the second time we do pre-orders. I did pre-orders with Tiny Reminder before. With user list, it's a big problem that people who buy it don't use it, like less than 50%. It might be a different story for things like the newsletter, because I mean, you receive it, you don't have to use it actively, right?
Right.
But with SaaS pre-orders, they can be so super tricky. We had Derek Reimer here talking about his story with Level on the show, and I'm sure he shared it on other shows as well. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. He has all the components in place with pre-orders, validation, everything. It still didn't work out. So,
yeah, I spoke to Derek about that because I love hearing stories about people who tried pre-sales and didn't work out, because I always want to dive so deep into what happened with that. When I reached out to Derek, he said a lot of it for him was that he had people who wanted to support him, like him as a person, right? We talk about creating a personal audience. In a large way, that's what you're doing with this podcast too, is like people get to know you and care about you and want you to succeed. I think sometimes the downside to that can happen with pre-sales. I don't know if this is what happened to you, but sometimes you get people who are, hey, I just really want to support you. And then you're like, oh, that's the people want the product. And it's like, well, they kind of want you to be the person running the product, and that they might not care about the product as much. And that can definitely happen sometimes. And that's something to be wary of. Do you feel like that resonates with your first experience, or was it random people who had never met you, liked the idea, pre-sold it, and then never spoke to you again?
We had a mix of real good friends who bought it, and they downright said that they just want to support us. And some people who didn't know us, and then, yeah, sure, the personal audience factor definitely plays in. And, well, it's still better than nothing, for sure. Mm-hmm. But it's, unfortunately, it's not a guarantee. And it's interesting that almost all of these lessons, they're available out there, but you wouldn't really, like, you have to make the mistake in order to own the lesson.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, all these things with the new markets and everything, I had known it before, but I was somehow blindfolded with the idea and how unique and amazing it is. And that's what entrepreneurs do, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's always the scale of how much, because like with my first product, I remember being like, I have 200 email subscribers. I didn't do any pre-sales with that. I said 200 email subscribers, they're going to convert. Like, email average is 5%. So that's this many sales of this many dollars. And none of that ended up happening. And part of that, you have to, you know, you don't learn, like, don't trust your email list until it hits you that one time, that first time, right? Where you think, yeah, all these sales are going to come from it. And it turns out it doesn't. And you have to say, okay, well, I need to be prepared. I can't take that as a guarantee. And I think that's the same thing you're saying here with pre-sales. Like, even though pre-sales are probably better than an email, someone giving you an email address, it's not a guarantee. You can't promise that people are then going to use the app forever. You know, maybe they were really excited in the moment, but, you know, 2 months later, they're like, eh, this just doesn't fit my day-to-day flow. For CoderNotes, a big problem that I had, that users had with it, is it's a big behavior change for people to actually start taking notes while they develop. It's just, if it's not already a habit you have, then it's really hard to justify paying for a product. You might even pay for it at first, but then you're not going to have the habit built in. So you're not going to use it and then eventually say, well, this is kind of worthless.
Yeah. And info products and SaaS are so dramatically different in that regard, because if an info product is an impulse buy, well, it's on your bookshelf. It's okay. Like, you read it, you don't read it, it's fine. But with the SaaS, it's a recurring purchase and you really have to be using it. So all these kind of imperfections, they are just out there up front.
Yeah, definitely. It's so interesting too. Like, Level didn't work with pre-sales, but a tuple did. And it's like, I want to get to the bottom. This is a problem that's so interesting to me, and I want to dive deeper to the bottom of it, because I think the biggest thing that early founders could be doing right now is figuring out ways to de-risk their business. Instead of just falling in love with an idea, building it in isolation for 5 or 6 months, and then releasing it to silence, which is so demotivating and so frustrating as how much time you put into it. If you can find a way to de-risk it, figure out that earlier on that it's going to has a better chance of being successful, that is just the dream, I think. And that's what I'm trying to work towards learning so I can share with others.
There's a book called The Mom Test that we should definitely link to. It's like the recommended reading for anyone who does customer interviews and tries to validate their product. But I want to ask you, what are your personal criteria for measuring how realistic and attractive the idea is? One, we already mentioned the existing market. I would like to add to that it's amazing to have a well-defined keyword, because we are running into that with UseList a lot. There are like a dozen ways to describe what we do, even though the market exists. So the next time we might do something more well-defined. What are your personal criteria?
Yeah. So I think there's founder fit for products. So there's a bunch about, is this the type of product where it's only going to be successful if you're, you know, the best AI solution, right? If that's how your product competes in the market, like your AI does the best out of all the competitors, that's going to involve a lot of dev effort, especially as it grows, as you're competing with the bigger companies and even VC backed companies. If it really got to that level, you just have to be ready in the future to commit to that level of product development. So if that's not you, if you want a, you know, company of one type product where it's just going to be you and maybe it's kind of more passive income, that's not what you want to be building. I also think it makes sense for founders to think about their ambition level with the product. You know, it's great to imagine that you'll have a product doing $1 million a month, but maybe that's not where you start. Maybe you're working a full-time job, and on the side you want to build something that's going to start giving you that consistent income just so you can get to that 10K MRR level. And at that point, you're going to be able to quit your job or switch to part-time. If that's your ambition, you know, don't start something that's going to compete with Google, or be like me and think you're going to build a product that competes with Stack Overflow. It's highly ambitious, and there's a lot of ways to make good money on the internet that have the ambition that matches someone working on a side project. So that's the founder side of it. When I have an opportunity that fits kind of those check boxes for me about how much I want to work on it, how difficult it's going to be to implement, does it match, you know, my skills? Once I have all of that, I start looking at, we talked about the market. And for me, that's trying to figure out if people really are willing to pay for a product. The other things I think founders skip that they need to look at is, well, product risk is one. And that's the risk that you can't build the product. And some founders miss this with really complex solutions, like an AI solution. Like, oh, I'll just make an AI that's going to be the best and do all these things. And then, well, it turns out you can't actually build it because it's too hard to do. The typical example is someone who's like, I'm going to build the cure for cancer. It's like, great. You know, it's in demand. It's a good market. You know, like, that's not the problem. The problem is that you better figure out how to build that solution. So the risk there isn't in the market. It's in the product itself, being able to build it. So I think about that risk. And then the other thing I try to validate is channel risk, which I think is what you're talking about when it comes to like having a good keyword. Every founder assumes that like, oh, my product's so good that like people will find it, like they'll just get shared around and word of mouth, or like we'll get one big company and then all the others will just be lining up after that. And that's not really what happens. So I think it's really important, especially early on in a product, to try to find at least one channel where you can reliably get interest and attention, and maybe even leads, depending. Like, for me, if I'm pre-sailing, I want to find a channel that's causing pre-sales to happen that I can kind of reliably put effort into, and then, you know, results come back. So yeah, basically checking out the channel, looking at the market risk, and then all those things about, does this fit me? Does this idea fit me as a founder?
These are wonderful. I'm actually amazed at your level of wisdom as a founder slash developer, having just one product under your belt with so many insights already owned by you, because they usually come with years of experience and such.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I feel like one of my bigger strengths is just that I'm really focused on what I'm doing wrong, really focused on what I can learn from experiences I have. So I think that lets me kind of identify what I can do better the next time, every single time I go through this. And I have had other things in the past, but they weren't SaaS, and I ran a cleaning company for a while, so I have some business experience. But I called my podcast The First Time Founder because it was really my first time as a SaaS, you know, doing internet stuff. That was the first time really doing that.
Awesome. To that criteria list, I would really love to add a couple more things to think about. One is vitamin or painkiller kind of products, because vitamins are typically easier to adopt, but they're also easier to abandon. Meanwhile, business essential products, they are much more essential and the churn is lower. But on the other hand comes this problematic adoption, which means that people have to change their business processes and everything. So that can be challenging. Another thing to think about is how resource heavy the software is going to be. Like, if you compare, I don't know, a to-do list with an application that tracks millions of data points of user behavior and then is doing email sending at scale, then the other one is like a firehouse crazy thing compared to like productivity system or something like that. And yeah, you just should be thinking about what you're getting in at scale for a long time. Right.
100%. Yeah, I totally agree. I think the vitamin painkiller is another really good way of looking at what I'm talking about when I say making sure there's money trading hands. Because at the end of the day, if you're looking for a product that's, and I think typically when people talk about the vitamin or painkiller, I don't know if this is your thought as well, but a lot of times I hear you better be going for the painkiller, like avoid the vitamin there in that conversation. And I think that boils down to, you want, especially as a bootstrapper, you don't want to spend marketing dollars convincing people that your product is worthwhile. Like with software ideas, I'm not spending money convincing people that, you know, finding a software idea is worthwhile. You know, we're targeting founders who already know, like, I want to be a founder. I want to build companies. What I'm missing is like that idea that I really feel confident with, that I can take off and run with. I'm missing that kind of seed. And, you know, I gave an example once. It's a really silly example, but if there's someone out there who like wants to buy an apple, you can try to sell them a banana and say, hey, this is better for you, or more vitamin K, whatever. And you might get the sale. It just would have been way easier to sell the apple to them.
Yeah, it's like, it's always easy to sell ice cream on the beach, even though there is like a dozen of ice cream stands, they still get sales, exactly. Each of them. I also love your approach as to new projects as learnings, because as founders, we're always going to have failures at different levels, and being able to learn from your experience is like number one skill. That and, I don't know, patience to go on, I guess.
Yeah, I think I was pretty ambitious. This is something I still think about, because I was pretty aggressive in deciding to move for a new product as opposed to continuing on with my original one. A lot of that just came, and I mean, I wasn't sure until I started seeing results on the other way, but I was like, maybe I need to pivot. Like, I don't know if there's a book called, I think, The Startup J Curve, which talks about how they call it morphing, but it's essentially pivoting. They say morphing is inevitable for a company. It's like required to happen in order to be successful. And I was like, well, I haven't morphed yet, so maybe that's what I need to do. And I think where I just came down to it and I said, I would be happier starting over and being able to use the things I've learned as opposed to taking the existing product and fitting it. So I don't know. That's not advice, because I don't know if that was a good decision or a bad decision. It's just been interesting to see now, like I'm really happy with where I'm at, obviously, and to look at other founders who have a product and maybe they're trying to position it or morph it entirely and maybe are struggling to find that. I don't know. The question of when to stop an idea when it's not working is impossible to solve. And I wish I had. It's just a question. The reason I'm rambling is because I have no insights to it. And it's just something I'm really interested in and been thinking about a lot.
There is no single word answer.
Yeah.
No,
I wish there was. Wouldn't it be nice if it's just like, oh, you know, 183 days. And after at 184, you know, you stop. And 183, you keep going. But no.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, can you give us an insight? Who is the potential audience for your newsletter? So who will benefit from receiving ideas? And I'd like to point out that it's not exactly ideas that you're selling, but more like validated ideas, researched ideas, because ideas themselves are like a dime a dozen, basically, but you sell product research, correct?
Yep. I think of myself as kind of a researcher. I'm looking at markets and I'm trying to identify opportunities where bootstrappers can make a dent and compete and win. So yeah, it is different than just ideas. It's not just something that came off the top of my brain. Most of these newsletters take 20 plus hours to research and write and edit. So it's not a short amount of work. And who would benefit most from this? I think if you're the type of founder who believes that, you know, the best idea might not necessarily come from your direct hobbies or interests, and you're interested in looking at markets that you might have not been exposed to otherwise, markets where you're focusing on the actual demand that exists there. And if you're a founder, you're saying, hey, look, I'm ready to start something, but my struggle has been around finding the ideas and also learning how to take that idea, go even further past validation into verifying that it's going to be successful, doing the due diligence you need to take that idea and bring it to initial traction, initial product market fit. That's the type of person I'm trying to reach.
That's so great. And organically, where can people find your project online?
Yeah, so you can go to softwareideas.io, and that's going to take you right to the newsletter and subscription. You can take a look at that. If you want to reach out to me personally, I'm on Twitter @Kev_Conti. And also, I have a blog, kevinconti.com. There's not too much that's interesting there, but I do have a daily Software Ideas blog where that's really more my daily stand-up, in a sense. So if you're interested in kind of the behind the scenes and really want to see like what it's like from my perspective, what I'm working on, what I'm worried about, I have recorded daily blogs almost every day since it was originally founded. So you can look at my initial concerns from when I was first doing the idea and I have a post there, like a really bad day I had. And you can just look at all the highs and lows. It's a cool story to follow. So that's on my personal blog at kevinconti.com.
Amazing. I was going to ask you, how do you feel about, you know, being on a content production treadmill? But it feels like you're used to that very well, right?
It's tough. It is tough. But, and something we were briefly talking about right before we started was, with info products, it's nice because you can get that instant sale, but you lose out on the SaaS recurring revenue. Newsletters are really interesting because you can get both. You actually get the recurring revenue, and you might get the recurring revenue because it's a subscription. And you also get the info product kind of, it's a little bit easier to get sales. You're not trying to get someone to start up a whole new software. So that, yeah, it's really interesting. But the downside of it is that you have to keep, you know, trucking along with content every single week. This newsletter in particular takes a lot of time. So far, you know, the effort has been well worth the reward. It's been very rewarding to see almost 200 people now who are reading every article and really getting value out of it. So I guess I'm getting used to it. Yeah.
I also heard that you have added your project to Open Startups. So can we link to that?
Yeah, definitely. We can give you the link to that.
Awesome. Well, I'd like to point out, actually, there is one more model between info products. Well, it was somebody else that told me this idea that really stuck with me. Essentially, having an audience and publishing a book every season pretty much equals in revenue to just running a SaaS consistently, but with way less stress. And people don't have to commit to a subscription at all, but they just keep buying stuff from you. So that's just another seed in people's mind that we can plant today.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so, so much for sharing your wisdom, and really, really appreciate your insights today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun.
Awesome. Have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thanks, you too.